Today's share is entitled Jonas Phillips, the First American Jewish Ger Toshav, Religious Liberty, Ger Vitoshav, and the American Experiment. If you ever visit Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home in Virginia, you'll probably expect to hear about the Declaration of Independence, about the founding of the United States, and about one of America's most important founding fathers. But there's something most visitors never notice. Somewhere in the grounds is a small Jewish grave. A woman named Rachel Phillips Levy is buried there. And that should make us pause. What is a Jewish grave doing on Jefferson's estate? Who was she? And how did a Jewish immigrant family from Philadelphia end up quietly and unexpectedly connected to one of the most famous names in American history? And the answer leads us into one of the most fascinating and overlooked stories in American Jewish history. Rachel's father was Jonas Phillips. He arrived in America with almost nothing. A poor immigrant, no status, no security, no guarantee of belonging. And yet, over the course of his life, he did something extraordinary. He supported the American Revolution. He became a successful merchant. He helped found one of America's earliest synagogues. He challenged religious discrimination and direct correspondence with the founding fathers. And he helped shape what religious liberty would actually mean in the United States. But beneath all of that is a deeper question. What does it mean to be fully Jewish and fully American at the same time? Jonas Phillips was one of the first Jews to show that America made possible something new in Jewish history, something Rabbi Soloveitchik would later describe as living as both a ger and a toshav, a stranger and a resident at the same time, a person fully part of society and fully committed to a distinct covenantal identity. That idea sounds familiar to us now, but in the 18th century, it was revolutionary. To understand how radical this is, we need to remember what Jewish life looked like before America. For centuries, Jews in Europe lived with a basic uncertainty about belonging. They were expelled from England, France, and Spain. They were forced into ghettos. They faced blood libels, expulsions, and periodic violence. Even where they were tolerated, they were not equal. In most places, Jews could not own land, join guilds, or enter many professions. And most importantly, they could not fully participate in government or public life. Even in more tolerant places like Amsterdam or England, there was always a limit. Jews could trade, worship, even become wealthy, but they were still marked as different. Even in a country like England, one of the more tolerant places in Europe, Jews were still blocked from full participation for a long time. The problem was simple but powerful. To serve in parliament, you had to swear a Christian oath, and that meant Jews were automatically excluded. Even after the American Revolution, these barriers were still in place. For example, Lionel de Rothschild was elected parliament in the 1800s, but he could not take his seat because he would not swear a Christian oath. And a Jewish leader named Sir Isaac Leon Goldsmith spent much of his life fighting to remove those restrictions so that Jews could finally participate in public life as equals. So even in Western Europe, the message for Jews was still clear. You may live here, but you are not fully part of the political system. The message was consistent. You may live here, you may contribute here, but you do not fully belong here. That was the world Jonas Phillips was born into. Then came something unusual. William Penn, founded in Pennsylvania in 1681, with a simple but powerful idea. People should be free to follow their own religious beliefs without government control or pressure. And that meant that the government did not choose a main or official religion, and there was no state church that everyone had to belong to or support. Instead, people of different faiths were allowed to live together, worship in their own way, and practice their religion freely according to their conscience without being forced into any one belief system. And that meant there was no official state religion and no church that everyone was required to support or belong to. Instead, people of different faiths were allowed to live, worship, and practice their religion in peace according to their own conscience. Not perfect, but different. For the first time, Jews in a British colony could imagine not only survival, but participation. They could build institutions, they could engage in commerce, and they could begin to imagine belonging. Into that world came Jonas Phillips. He was born in 1736 in Germany. He arrived in America in 1756 as a poor immigrant. He worked as an indentured servant in Charleston to pay off his passage. From there, he slowly rebuilt his life, moving to Albany, then New York, eventually becoming a merchant. He joined the Freemasons, like many ambitious colonial men, entering networks that included figures like Washington and Franklin. He married into a respected Sephardic family. He worked as a shochet, and over time, he moved from the margins into the center of both Jewish and colonial life. Then history broke open. The American Revolution created instability for everyone, but especially for minorities. And Jews had to decide, stay quiet or take a side. Jonas Phillips chose the Patriot cause, and that decision mattered. It was risky, it was uncertain, and when New York became unsafe under British occupation, he moved with other Jewish families to Philadelphia, the center of the revolution. Not just fleeing danger, but stepping directly into the heart of the new American experiment. One of the most remarkable surviving documents from this period is a letter Phillips wrote in Yiddish in July of 1776. It was intercepted by the British and sent back to England because they weren't even sure what they were looking at. It reads like a business letter. He is simply trying to send money to his mother, first of all, and stated July 28th, 1776, Sunday 12, Menachem Av, 5536. So this is just a few weeks after the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And he writes the following. After he mentions that he's trying to send money to his mother. Again, this is written in Yiddish. But then he says, and this is the translation, as no English goods can come over at all, and much money can be earned with Holland goods if one will venture, should you have a friend who will this winter acquaint himself with the goods mentioned below, I can assure you that 400% is to be earned thereby. I could write my meaning better in English than Judeo-German, meaning there's a lot of money to be made if you send over products, and he has a list of products, to this country. And he writes, he predicts the war will make all England bankrupt. The Americans have an army of 100,000 fellows, and the English only 25,000 and some ships. And then he writes in Yiddish, the Americans have already made themselves like the states of Holland. And then he says, that the Ein Geschlagenen is Ein Declaration von die ganze Medina, meaning the enclosed is a declaration of the ganze Medina, the whole country. So, and he enclosed with this letter the Declaration of Independence. So you can imagine that the British, like he wanted to send it by way of Saint Eustatia, which was a an island that was owned by the Dutch. So he wanted to avoid the British, but the British intercepted it. So they find this letter. It's written in Yiddish, so they don't understand it. And encloses the Declaration of Independence. So they think there's some kind of secret code written in a foreign language, even though it's really a Yiddish letter, including the Declaration of Independence. But he calls, and he writes, and he says, Wie es wird ausgehen, der Oberster weiß es. How will it end? Oh, God only knows. But he refers to the declaration Yiddish as the declaration of the ganze Medina, the whole country. That phrase matters because it shows something striking. Only 3 weeks after July 4, 1776, Jonas Phillips is already thinking of America as one country, not a loose collection of colonies, a nation. Even many political leaders were still unsure what this new American experiment actually meant. For example, in the letters of Abigail Adams, wife of John Adams, second president of the United States, written at the same time, she often referred to America in terms of the states, reflecting how uncertain and fluid the idea of a single unified nation still was in the years after independence. But a Jewish immigrant merchant in Philadelphia already sees its forming. He is not a founding father, but he is a witness who understands what is happening in real time. Phillips lived in a global trading system stretching from Europe to the Caribbean to North America. Goods moved through ports such as St. Eustatius, as I mentioned, a Dutch-controlled island in the Northern Caribbean, which became an important hub shaping wartime commerce and trade routes. And Phillips adapted quickly, supplied goods to the Continental Army. He took advantage of the wartime disruption, and by the end of the Revolution, he had become a successful merchant with property stability and standing. But what matters most is this. His success did not come at the expense of his Judaism. He did not assimilate. He did not fade into the surrounding culture. He remained observant. He kept Shabbos and kashrus. He helped found Congregation Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia. He raised a traditional Jewish family. He remained visibly and proudly Jewish in public life. In 1787, Benjamin Rush, a physician who was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, one of the leading intellectuals of the new nation, attended the wedding of Philip's daughter, Rachel. We have a letter where Rush describes this wedding and what he saw. He writes that at 1 o'clock, the company consisting of 30 or 40 men assembled in Mr. Phillips' common parlor, which is accommodated with benches for the purpose. The ceremony began with prayers in the Hebrew language, which were chanted by an old rabbi, and in which he was followed by the whole company. As I did not understand the word except now and then an Amen or a Halukah, my attention was directed to the haste with which they covered their heads with their hats as soon as the prayers began, and to the freedom with which some of them conversed with each other during the whole time of this part of their worship. Meaning he was witnessing mincha, and they quickly put on their yarmulkes, and then also they were talking a lot during davening. And then he describes the wedding ceremony, that there was a small piece of parchment was produced, written in Hebrew, which contained a deed of settlement, and which the groom subscribed in the presence of four witnesses. In this deed, he conveyed a part of his fortune to his bride, by which he was provided for after his death in case she survived him. So this obviously was the ksuva question why he writes there were four witnesses. Maybe there was the rabbi and someone else, but the rabbi himself wasn't the witness, but I'm not sure. He describes so the ceremony was followed by the erection of a beautiful canopy composed of white and red silk in the middle of the floor. He describes the chuppah. He talks about how the bride entered veiled. The groom placed the ring in the hand of the bride. There was a cup of wine that is shared that he describes. A glass is broken. And after the ceremony, Rush learned something else. Also, that he writes that the bride and the groom have been fasting in accordance with Jewish law for the entire day. Nothing about this ceremony was adjusted to fit American expectations, and yet it took place in the heart of Philadelphia during the constitutional era in the presence of one of America's founding fathers. The message is simple but powerful. You can be fully American without becoming less Jewish. Rav Soloveitchik later gave language to what Philip was already living. In the Torah, Avram describes himself as Ger V'Toshav Anochi Imachem in Parshas Chayesara. He's a stranger and a resident. Rav Soloveitchik writes, in Reflections of the Rav, Abraham's definition of his dual status, we believe, describes with profound accuracy the historical position of the Jew who resides in a predominantly non-Jewish society. He was a resident, like other inhabitants of Canaan, sharing with them a concern for the welfare of society, digging wells, contributing to the progress of the country in loyalty to its government and institutions. Here, Avram was clearly a fellow citizen, a patriot among compatriots, joining others in advancing the common welfare. However, there was another aspect, the spiritual, which Avram regarded himself as a stranger. His identification and solidarity with his fellow citizens in the secular realm did not imply his readiness to relinquish any aspects of his religious uniqueness. He was a different faith, and he was governed by perceptions, truths, and observances, which set him apart from the larger faith community. In this regard, Avram and his descendants would always remain strangers. According to Rav Soloveitchik, a Jew is meant to live in both roles, a toshav, fully engaged in society, contributing, building, participating, and a ger, spiritually distinct, bound to a covenant that sets them apart. For most of history, Jews were forced to choose one or the other. In Europe, you could be Jewish, but not fully belong. Or you could belong, but only giving up what made you Jewish. America introduced something new, the possibility of being both. Phillips understood this clearly. In 1787, just before the Constitution was signed, Jonas Phillips wrote to George Washington. He objected to the, and the letter, first of all, dated Philadelphia, 24th of Elul, 5547, September 7th, 1787. He writes a letter to George Washington and the honorable members of the convention assembled. So he's writing a letter to Washington, and he's dating it not just the English date, but also the Hebrew date. And he writes the following. He says that he is being one of the people called Jews in the city of Philadelphia, people scattered and dispersed among all nations, do behold with concern that among the laws of the Constitution of Pennsylvania, there's a clause And here's what the clause said. I do believe in one God, the creature and governor of the universe, or creator of the governor of the universe, the rewarder of the good and the punisher of the wicked. And I do acknowledge the scriptures of the Old and New Testament to be given by divine inspiration. That's what it said. And Phillips writes, to swear and believe that the New Testament was given by divine inspiration is absolutely against the religious principle of a Jew and is against his conscience to take any such oath. By the above law, a Jew is deprived of holding any public office or place of government, which is contradictory to this Bill of Rights. And then he writes that all men have a natural and unalienable right to worship Almighty God according to the dictates of their own conscience and understanding. And no man ought or of right can be compelled to attend any religious worship or erect or support any place of worship or maintain any minister contrary to or against his own free will and consent. Right? So he writes that he objects to the idea that public officials might be required to swear Christian oaths. And he writes that all men have a natural and inalienable right to worship God according to the dictates of their own conscience. This is not just a Jewish argument, it's an American argument. And in fact, it helped shape Article 6 of the Constitution, which prohibits religious tests for public office. A few years later, that principle was tested again. In 1793, Phillips was called to testify in court in Philadelphia. The date fell on Shabbos. He refused to attend. He would not violate Shabbos even for a court proceeding. He was fined $10. Later, the penalty was waived. But something important had happened. For one of the first times in American history, the legal system was forced to confront a new question. What happens when civic duty and religious obligation collide? And Phillips' answer was consistent. The state cannot require a Jew to stop being a Jew to participate in civic life. Many scholars have noted that this case, Stansberry versus Marx, U.S. Supreme Court, April 1, 1793, was among the earliest, or maybe the first, real-world test of free exercise of religion in America. When we put it all together, his life is striking. He was an immigrant who rebuilt from nothing. He was a merchant who prospered. He was a patriot who supported independence. He was a communal leader who helped build Jewish institutions. He was a religious liberty advocate who wrote to Washington, and a public Jew who lived openly in America. But the deeper truth is this. He proved that Jewish life did not have to retreat to survive modernity. It could stand in public fully intact. And that legacy did not end with him. It continued through his descendants in remarkable ways. One grandson, Mordechai Manuel Noah, became one of the earliest nationally prominent Jewish figures in America and was appointed by President James Madison in 1813 as U.S. Consul to Tunis, representing the United States abroad at a very early stage of American diplomacy. Another grandson, Commodore Uriah Phillips Levy, rose to become a distinguished officer in the United States Navy and later extraordinarily entered American cultural history, because after Thomas Jefferson died in 1826, his estate at Monticello fell into ruin because of overwhelming debts. The home of one of America's greatest champions of religious liberty, the author of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, was in danger of being lost. In 1834, Levy purchased Monticello, not for profit, but out of deep reverence for Jefferson's ideals of liberty of conscience. He spent his own resources restoring and preserving the estate, determined that Jefferson's legacy would not disappear. And there is a striking historical irony here. Jonas Phillips had written to the Constitutional Convention asking whether Jews would be truly accepted as equal citizens in America. Within two generations, his own grandson became the man who preserved the home of Jefferson himself. And the story becomes even more personal. Levy's mother, Rachel Phillips Levy, the daughter of Jonas Phillips, died while visiting Monticello in 1839. At her request, she was buried on the grounds of Jefferson's estate. Her grave remains there to this day, a permanent Jewish presence on the land of one of America's founding symbols of liberty. Taken together, the story is extraordinary. Jonas Phillips petitioned the Constitutional Convention asking that Jews receive full civil equality. Within a generation or two, his descendants were helping shape America itself in very different but complementary ways. One representing the United States abroad, another preserving one of its founding homes, others building Jewish communal life in the nation's capital. The family that once asked to be included in America became a family that helped build and preserve America. Jonas Phillips is not important because he was the first American Jew. And he's not important because he stood near the founding fathers. He's important because he understood something early. The American experiment was not finished when the Declaration was signed. It had to be lived into reality. Jefferson helped define a nation of citizens. Phillips helped define something else, a nation where Jews could be citizens without ceasing to be Jews. And that is the real meaning of his life. And in that sense, he lived what Rav Soloveitchik later described, the dignity of the Jew who was both rooted in an ancient covenant and fully present in the modern world. So the question he leaves us with is simple. Are we Americans or Jews? Or can we be something more difficult and more beautiful? Ger and Toshav, fully engaged in society, fully faithful to covenant. Before America, Jews often had to choose, Jew in private, citizen in public. Jonas Phillips refused that split. And America, at its best, made space for something new. Jews in the home and Jews in the street. Jews in private life and Jews in public life. That is his legacy. Not a footnote in history, but a voice from the founding generation still speaking to us. And in the 250th anniversary moment, his question returns with force. If America once made it possible to live Jewish life openly and fully, what are we doing today to preserve, deepen, and pass that gift forward? That is not only his story, it is ours as well.